The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. There's a decent chance that the story we're about to tell you today is one of the biggest stories in your life. And there's a decent chance that you don't realize it. If you happen to be on the giving end of our topic, you will recognize it as soon as we start talking. If you happen to be on the receiving end, you probably won't, and that's the problem. If the headline conversation around equality this year was topped by Me Too and the discussion of representation in boardrooms and in C-suites, then the other side of that conversation, the quieter side, was about everything else that isn't balanced, that's never been balanced. So maybe if you start listening to our guest in this episode and you think that this conversation has nothing to do with you, that might mean you're the person who needs it the most. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Gemma Hartley is a writer, the author of Fed Up, Emotional Labor, Women, and the Way Forward. Gemma, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Why don't we just start with defining emotional labor? What is it?
So emotional labor, as I am describing it in the book, is the invisible mental and emotional work that we do to keep those around us comfortable and happy.
What was the last piece of emotional labor you performed? Can you remember it?
There was a lot of emotional labor going on this morning while I was trying to keep everyone in the restaurant, you know, comfortable and happy because the restaurant in my hotel did not open this morning. And
oh, no.
I was the first one down for breakfast and I felt very awkward about it. And so I was trying to make sure that everyone felt okay and that they didn't have to, you know, you don't need to tend to me. It's fine.
But they do need to tend to you. That is your hotel.
Yes. But, you know, at the same time, I'm very socially conditioned to make sure that everyone around me is comfortable and that I am not the one causing discomfort.
And that's the main thing that I took away from your book, is that I am not wired that way.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say wired, but definitely socially conditioned.
Yeah, not attuned to it,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I think that's really the main difference that I want people to understand, is that it's not something that is hardwired into us,
yes,
that, you know, women are much better at emotional labor than men. But we are trained for it from a very young age. And so we experience the world in a very different way, which is sort of what I found out during the research of doing this book, was that I wanted to figure out why my husband and I had this big disconnect when it came, mm-hmm, to emotional labor. Because he is very progressive. He's a very equal partner. But he did not see the emotional labor that I was doing. He didn't understand it. And it was because we were raised very differently. And I saw it everywhere, and he wasn't even aware of it.
What does that training look like at a young age?
At a young age, it usually looks like watching your parents and watching how adults interact with one another. And kids pick up on mom being the one that does everything behind the scenes, and being the one that is always tending to everyone's emotional needs. And so I think that's really where it starts. And then as we get older, there are a lot of other things that come into play, you know, in our social conditioning that tell us that women need to, you know, quiet themselves, become a little, mm-hmm, bit smaller, make everyone comfortable in those ways. So it kind of grows and compounds as we get older.
How far back does this conversation or the attempt to define invisible labor or emotional labor go?
So it really depends. There has been a lot of debate about my use of the term emotional labor.
Really?
Yes, because it's not being used in the way that it was intended. Arlie Hochschild defined emotional labor. She coined the term back in the 80s. And it was really just about emotion management in the workforce and in service sector jobs specifically, like airline attendants. And
right,
their need to, you know, create that nice, homey, comfortable atmosphere. Mm. And the way that I'm looking at it is more how that looks in the broader world, how it looks in our homes, in the workforce outside of service sector, and how we keep people comfortable in these invisible ways.
So you started this conversation with an article in Harper's Bazaar.
Yes.
That's more than a year ago.
Yes.
So first of all, why do you think that article got so much attention? And what has happened to the conversation around it in the years since?
I think what really made that article go so viral is that this definition of emotional labor really combines the mental and emotional work and the way that they intersect and compound and ultimately really frustrate us. We didn't have a word for that. We didn't have a term for that before. And so I think that is why it went so viral, is that a lot of women pointed at that and said, this is the thing I've been feeling and didn't know how to express. And so having that, you know, new language to talk about it has made a tremendous difference. And then in the year since, I've seen a lot of conversations start to come around the term emotional labor, and women are really ready to talk about this and talk about the ways that we can balance it out in our lives and make it more equal.
What have you heard from men who are entering this conversation for the first time? Because I will say, as probably happens to a lot of men who read that article, it was sent to me by my wife. And as soon as I saw it, in the same way that you describe your husband, I felt seen. I also consider myself a progressive man who helps at home, who does dishes, who cooks dinner. You know, I contribute a lot of the, or at least I contribute some of the actual tasks, but it never entered my mind, really, the complex organization that goes on behind it. And what have you heard in your discussions from men who are encountering this for the first time?
I've heard some mixed reviews, obviously.
Really?
Some men, especially with the article, because I did write that specifically for a female audience and did not anticipate it going as big as it did. I might have been a little bit more careful with my words had I known how big it would get.
In what sense? I'm just interested now.
Well, I think when I wrote that, I was writing out like from a very frustrated viewpoint, you know, what women are experiencing. And so that doesn't leave a lot of room for men to feel welcomed into the conversation, which is something that I hope the book does, because I think this is a conversation that men and women need to be having. And I don't want it to be one that puts men on the defense. I think it's one where men should really be welcomed in and be able to share their experience and really come to the table wanting to learn more instead of feeling like they need to defend themselves.
Well, it's hard not to feel on the defensive when you see yourself portrayed so accurately. And also you're just like, shit, that's me.
Yeah, I can see that. But, you know, I think a lot of it really does have to do with the way that we're socialized.
Yeah.
And I have gotten really good feedback from men who are ready to, you know, step up and say, okay, I can see where I'm contributing to this problem. Where do we go from here? And that's really heartening to see that, you know, there are men that are ready to step up and start taking initiative for this.
Up next,
the personal culture that we have of overpraising men for emotional labor like that. It definitely needs to go because it's setting women up for failure and setting men up for this false sense of accomplishment.
We all have investment goals, and Scotia iTrade can help you reach yours. Access free tools and resources to sharpen your investment skills. Visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. Scotia iTrade, there's a trader in all of us. One of the things that you did in your book, as well as partly in the article as well, is go beyond the kind of anecdotal rage that we can all feel, but also attempt to quantify it. How do you quantify the amount of emotional labor that women do?
So this is really tricky because it is hard to quantify because it is invisible work. It's mental and it's emotional, and you can't really, you know, write it all down on a piece of paper. You can't quantify the running list that you have going in your head all the time. But really, after talking to just like hundreds of women and hearing from thousands more after the article came out, it's very clear that women are the ones doing this type of work. So it's pretty plain to see when you're the one, you know, conducting all of the interviews. And I have talked to men who do this work as well. But generally, I found that the men I was talking to who really strongly related to the article and to that type of work, were living outside of like the traditional norms. They weren't in that like cis, hetero, you know, man going to work every day, woman staying at home, which was really like, you know, where I was coming from. I work from home and we have this very traditional setup. The men that were experiencing this did not have that same traditional setup in their lives.
How do you open that conversation with your partner besides simply sending him your article and saying, check this out? But you mentioned that there's a whole other, you talk in your book about other ways to open that conversation.
Yes. And, you know, my article, maybe not the best way. That can come off as a little bit attacking. And
I don't know. I thought it worked for me, but there's got to be other.
It does. It definitely works for some people and not for others. I had some women say like, oh, I feel your article so strongly, but I could never show it to my husband, which I'm like, really?
But what's the gentle way then?
So I think opening up this conversation from a cultural perspective is really important. Talking about the different ways that we were raised and socialized so that it's not talking about what the other person is doing wrong, but sort of talking about the wrong ideas that we may have picked up in our childhood and adolescence that, you know, stick without us really examining them. And that's really what it comes down to, is having really intentional conversations about this and being really intentional about the emotional labor we take on in our lives.
If we're talking about cultures and the way they're enforced, is there a place in the world that has managed to do better at sharing the workload?
When I was looking at most like westernized civilization, we're pretty much all in this not so great space together. What I did find, though, was that there is a tribe, the Aka tribe, where fathers take on at least 50%, if not more, of the emotional labor. And they have this really interesting dynamic within the tribe where men and women are very interchangeable in their roles, both in parenting and in hunting and gathering. And so what that tells me is that this is not a hardwired thing.
Right.
This is a socialization thing. They live outside of Western socialization. And so it seems very natural for fathers to, you know, be staying at home with the children and, you know, doing all of the emotional labor that women would normally be doing in Western civilization. So I think that we're all sort of, you know, needing to rewire our brains to work in that more equal, from that more equal place.
Is there a way we can push it in that direction through anything it's possible for us to do, through policy, through government? Are there any examples out there of stuff like that that works?
Yes, I think there absolutely is. I think that's really where I want this conversation to eventually go. I'm starting with like the micro in the book and what it looks like to become equal in like relationships and in our personal lives. But really what that does is shift the culture to make room for policy change that is going to make it more equal for men and women. And I think one of the things I talk about a lot in the book, because I am from the U.S., is our really deplorable state of parental leave. That can cause a really big divide in emotional labor, because when there is only one parent and it's the mother that is allowed to even take any leave, they are the one that is at home, that is learning all of the things that need to be done, noticing those emotional cues with their children. It puts this really big burden on them to be the one that knows what to do all the time and then just relays that information to their partner. And that obviously causes a really big divide in how the mental load is managed.
There's also like cultural expectations around that, though, even beyond the U.S. having a deplorable policy around that, because we have a pretty decent paternal leave up here. And my wife is a freelancer. We had a baby. I took a month, and I could have taken more. I could have taken, because she's a freelancer, I could have taken the entire 10 months or a year, but I didn't feel like I could.
Yeah, and that's very true. There are those cultural pressures that say, you know, you should be back at work. Men should go back to work. They don't need all this time. And some countries have incentivized it for parents. Yes. So Sweden is one place, I believe, that has incentivized parents to take the full parental leave. That sort of gets men over that macho, like, you've got to get back to work culture in order to provide and do all of that. So they have made it more of an incentive for men to take that leave and to stay home. They get a sort of bonus for going, you know, staying out of work to spend that time with their children. And I think that really helps to change the way that men are seeing it, because, you know, why wouldn't they take the leave if it's more advantageous for them in terms of, you know, financially, it's more advantageous for them to stay home than go back to work. Like,
right.
why wouldn't you? And most men want to.
Yeah.
Most men want that time, but they feel conflicted because the culture is still not supporting that.
What's one thing men or anybody in a relationship who feels like after listening to this, that they're not doing their share of emotional labor can do immediately to start picking up some of that?
First of all, the biggest mistake that I see made is men
the one
will
I just
go,
made right now, probably?
No. Men will go and ask, well, they'll ask their partners,
right.
like, what can I do? And a big part of the emotional labor I'm talking about is constantly having to delegate. So I would say take the initiative to notice, like really take stock of your shared life, see what your partner is doing, and then just swoop in. And also don't expect a lot of praise when you do swoop in, because that's another part of this is that, you know, when men do the same job as women, they want a lot of praise for it. And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying thank you for a job well done, as long as you're both doing it in equal amount for the same sort of work.
In the relationship, it's one thing, though, but society is built to, like, I take my daughter to a drop-in and I get, like, congratulations, look at daddy bringing the kid in.
Oh, yeah.
It's like my wife takes her there.
All the time.
All the time. And nobody says, wow, you brought your daughter to the drop-in. That's what she does.
Yes. And that's why I think I wanted to focus so much on the personal culture that we have of overpraising men for emotional labor. Like that needs to stop in the culture. I'm sure it feels very good in some ways.
I will miss it, but I understand that it should probably go.
It definitely needs to go because it's setting women up for failure and setting men up for this false sense of accomplishment. You know, my husband has said that now he starts to, you know, people still do that to him all the time. Like, we've got three young kids and he takes them out and does stuff just as often as I do. And so he'll be taking all the kids grocery shopping and people like have to stop him and like just tell him he is so brave and
world's
so wonderful.
Dad.
And he's like, you know what? It kind of pisses me off because I'm better than that. I want to be equal with my partner. And, you know, no one's out there congratulating a woman for taking her children to the grocery store. A lot of the times they're rolling their eyes because one of the kids is having a tantrum, you know?
And that's, she must be a bad mom.
Oh, that bad mom. He's like, all three of them could be like laying on the floor screaming and people would still come up and like pat me on the back with congratulations.
Like, right. And they'd be like, you know what? They'd be like, you're babysitting.
Oh, yeah, the babysitting. Don't even get me started on that. You're parenting. It's your kids.
Why are we ready for these conversations now?
I think we are just at this cultural moment where women are speaking up and telling their truths. And I think we're just ready. Like, as a culture, we are ready. And we have had enough of, you know, these small, invisible inequalities. We've made a lot of progress, but we're still seeing that there is so much more underneath, you know, what we see on the surface.
Gemma, thank you so much for stopping in today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Gemma Hartley, author of Fed Up, Emotional Labor, Women, and the Way Forward, available now. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. And for more from us, we're at thebigstorypodcast.ca. For all your other episodes, for all your story ideas, send us some. And of course, you can find us on social media at Big Story Podcast, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And we would love a rating or a review from you on any podcast app. We are on them all, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. So tell us what you think. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk soon.